call to rest. Down on the griddle dam, stripped of your possessions in the outskirts of Iran. Shipped to the termination, source and liberation. Very much not coming from Lebanon.
Okay, I think this is working now. Good, okay.
Excellent.
So, it's weird that we're 2 hours apart and yet we're completely different seasons.
I know, it's bizarre. What's it been like there? Have you had any snow?
No snow here in Osaka. No, it's very rare that it would snow, but no, it's been chilly inside the house, which is the Japanese thing because they don't insulate the houses. Mm. So how was your Christmas? Did you got a yo-yo? You told me in a book about small houses.
Yeah, that was my Christmas presents from Janet, a yo-yo and a book on the Nano House, which, you know, is kind of like our dream apartment as a small, you know, we're both obsessed by bedsits, the kind of idea of a bedsit. So,
Why? Because you've got your own big house. Why are you obsessed with bedsits?
Because we both like small spaces as well as having this kind of large rambling house. We like the idea of a small space with kind of very little in it. So, and I've always wanted to streamline myself out of existence, and a kind of small nano house kind of space seemed a kind of good way to do it. You know, go out of the world the way you came into it, you know.
With nothing, owning nothing.
Yeah, which is kind of like, you know, I don't want to leave anything behind, so I'm starting early. I'm kind of working my way towards that now.
But you want to leave music behind.
Well, hey, I didn't make any for 30 years. So there's a reason for that.
Jesus was a Yeti, fooder and a creep. Jesus was a better
Well, really, so it's a Zen-like spiritual reason that you were silent for 30 years.
Well, I kind of felt that it was partly probably to do with my disenchantment after Orange Juice and the way that that kind of ended. And the, creatively, I just thought, do I really want to be making music? Is this kind of what I want to do with my life? And I kind of decided it sort of wasn't. I thought, I just kind of said to myself, there's enough songs in the world, you know. I don't need to try and add to it. You know, so that was kind of the reason I stopped making music. And I thought, I can do other, creatively I can write or draw or paint or garden or, you know, there was other ways of kind of having a creative outlet. So music really just kind of basically one day, you know, I not only sold my musical equipment, but I just gave away all my records. I gave away everything. And then I came to Australia. So really coming to Australia was like saying, okay, that I'm leaving that behind now. I'll give everything away I've got, my musical equipment, my record player, my records, and you know, and move on from that. So
let's be a bit Mojo Magazine here and go back to what you were giving up and what you were stopping exactly, because there's possibly unbelievably some people who don't know the story, you know, what was Orange Juice, who was David McClymont. And I just went to the Pop Caledonia page on Facebook, and there's your face on the banner at the top, you and Edwin, you know, representing with your, with your mop top and spiky hair, you know, that sort of Postcard Records era, and in fact the whole subsequent era. In a way, you're branding the whole image of Scottish pop, and I was, that's where I started with music as well, so I was very much in awe of what you guys were doing. I don't think we really crossed paths very much back in the day, though. Were you at Malcolm and Susan's wedding, for instance? Or
I met you two or three times, but it was kind of like what you were doing was kind of quite, it was more kind of in sort of Joseph K side of things than Orange Juice. I mean, it was more, you know, it wasn't really you weren't really doing a postcard thing as such, I didn't think.
Well, I wanted to be on Postcard Records, but it was just at the very tail end of it all, and Joseph K, you know, had disintegrated, and I was working with Malcolm and all the rest of it. But I was basically a literature student who was just trying to be Kafka or wanted to be Kafka, and then there was this band that was also wanting to be Kafka, and so that's really where my interest began. But I did like the shambolic and I liked also the attention that the music press was suddenly all over Scotland, and know, which they hadn't been previously.
Well, so really, the thing with Orange Juice was that the thing that attracted me to being in Orange Juice initially when I first met Edwin at college was that, to me, Orange Juice were like Pere Ubu. They sounded like a kind of crazy, experimental kind of art rock band. They didn't, you know, to me that was kind of what I was joining. I didn't think I was joining a kind of poppy, you know, melodic sort of songsmith kind of group. I thought it was more like, you know,
it was shambolic and everybody,
freeform kind of experimental music. And you know, have you never heard it on just rehearsals? Often that was kind of what they were like. It was maybe an hour of it just, you know, jamming in some kind of weird dancey kind of almost kind of like Pool or something, you know, which was way before Pool. But it was like that, it was more that kind of like Can, you know, I like bands like Can and Pere Ubu. And that, to me, probably mistakenly, was kind of like what I thought Orange Juice was sort of like, you know.
But also, you went through the whole evolution of signing to Polydor, and then you were the guy who found the TB-303 bassline composer, which became the signature sound of Orange Juice's one big commercial hit, If It's Up, Rip It Up. So in a way, you bear your share of the responsibility for that transition as well.
Well, you know, the thing was is that I guess I had a similar pop sensibility in a lot of ways to it, and in that I really like dance music and disco music and funk and, you know, whatever I did, I wanted it to have a rhythmic component, and Edwin liked that too, and kind of that was why I liked bands like more like krautrock, because they did, like Can had a really good kind of dance sensibility, but it was kind of a bit weird and a bit left field. Like they had that hit I Want More, which to me was like a great pop song, and so you know, in that sense we worked together quite well, but Edwin moved more and more towards really being a singer-songwriter, and when that happens, the group's really just becoming a backing group, and that was never what I wanted to be in a group to do, you know. And you know, Edwin had said to me, like, if you want to have your own group, then leave Orange Juice and set up your own group. But you know, I kind of, my insecurities were kind of such that I still wanted to be part of a gang, so to speak.
And you were a writer in Orange Juice. Which songs did you write?
No, I was really, you've kind of, don't know where you get that idea. I mean, really, Edwin was the main singer-songwriter on Orange Juice, and a lot of the problems that came with Orange Juice is that I felt that we should be working more on music that was collaboration, but Edwin was more and more moving towards the idea that the song, he'd bring the song in and the song was pretty much complete, so really that was kind of where, that was sort of how Honest just evolved. And by the time we were in Polydor and James was no longer in the group, James was the other songwriter, really, it was really just a one-man show. It was Edwin was doing all the songwriting, and Malcolm contributed a couple of songs to albums or to like the Rip It Up album, but it was just kind of like, and then at that point we decided we would try and do a record, which became Texas Fever. We try and make an album where we basically all contributed to the songwriting and see what happened then. But no, essentially, the songwriting was Edwin.
And so you were the bass player. What does it mean to be a bass player? What does a bass player know about? I mean, it's the backbone, supposedly, of the songs, of the chord structures. What is a bass player? That might sound like a stupid question, but what is a bass player?
God.
What is the secret knowledge of a bass player?
I mean, to me, being a bass player was really all about rhythm. It was all about creating good, solid dance rhythms. That was what I wanted to do with my bass playing. I mean, it was like, I never really chose to be a bass player. It was basically Edwin said to me one day at college, do you want to play in our band? And I was like, oh yeah, I'll do that. And the instrument of choice was the bass. So, you know, that was what I took up. And so really being a bass player was essentially just, you know, a good, solid, dancey, funky backing.
You said recently that you don't play bass by hand much more because it hurts your fingers.
Well, wasn't it? That's only because I hadn't played for 30 years.
Right. But you have a bass in the house, in your minimal house.
I still really like playing, you know, I played some real bass on this and the Momus McClymont 2 record, which was, you know, once I got into that again, that was great. But
which bit was that? Was that the... there's some really beautiful bass. I didn't know if it was a sample or not, but there's on the... what's the name? I forgot the name of the song now. The one that sounds like My Life in the Bush of Ghosts.
Yes, I play real bass in that one.
Oh, you play that? Those were great. I was cutting and pasting those thinking, wow, these are great little flourishes at the end of the lines. So that's real.
Yeah, that was me playing bass, and that's kind of...
Little Winners, it's called.
That's it. And that kind of stuff is actually, you know, it was good doing that again because, you know, you're more likely to kind of do those little flourishes on a bass guitar than you are on a keyboard.
Yeah.
So that was fun, you know, going back to that. And that was... You know, really, the way I'm playing bass guitar and that is really like almost identical how I would play bass for Orange Juice, you know, over 30 years ago. It's not, my bass playing didn't, I mean, really, when I stopped playing, it was kind of like I put down my musical instruments and when I picked them up again 30 years later, whether it was just a keyboard or a guitar, I hadn't really moved on from then because I hadn't done anything.
Yeah.
It was like I had gone to sleep for 30 years musically. So that kind of informed a lot of how, that I guess the first Momus McClymont album, the backing tracks that I had been working on for that when I first approached you were really, to me, that was, and as you know, it was like, you know, it was really retro, that stuff. And it was really because I hadn't really developed musically because I hadn't done anything musically. So, and that kind of worked because after, you know, 25 years or whatever, you know, that kind of sound had come back round to be popular again. So
yeah, 80s revival, yeah.
So it was a strange way to get back to being an 80s revivalist by just not playing for 30 years.
No, it's perfect. But why was the moment right again to suddenly get back into making music?
Well, it was really just, it was a kind of meaningful kind of coincidence, really, because... a friend of mine has a couple of kids and he had an iPad and his kids were fighting over the iPad and he just said to me, oh, you have the iPad, sick of the kids fighting over it. And so he gave me the iPad and it had GarageBand on it. Mm. And I knew that Damon Albarn had done a Gorillaz album with him using GarageBand. And I kind of thought, oh, I'll have a play around with this just in bed one morning. And basically I realized that it was kind of like how I had wanted to make music when I was in Orange Juice. It kind of gave me that complete freedom to, you know, there was no in-between man, there was no band members, there was just you and just, you know, and able to create something immediately. It was that kind of immediacy I really liked. So really that was just by mistake and I started messing around with that and then I realized, you know, I had a few tracks and songs and I thought, you know, I think I'll just continue with this and see where it goes. And then I moved from working on GarageBand and I just went on to Logic on an iMac. And really that was kind of, when I contacted you, initially I was sort of in the throes of trying to kind of make really what would have been an album. So that was kind of how I got back into it. It was completely by mistake. I had no intention of making music again. I really thought I'd never make music again. I'd been, you know, I'd done something with Mick Harvey. I'd played in his Serge Gainsbourg records, which was, what, 15 years before that, 10, 15 years. And I'd done a couple of other really small things, but that was really just, it wasn't really, you know, seriously looking at going back to playing music. So, yeah, it was accidental.
And for me, it was a really good counterbalance to where I was moving. I think with the Bibliotheque album and then Bambi, trying to get away a little bit from the garage band sound and trying to get more handmade, because I think it was so easy for people to make this shiny music on computers that I wanted to make really kind of handmade and organic and slightly rotten and flawed music in the spirit of Wabi Sabi. This Japanese aesthetic of imperfection. So, but the danger of that is that you get murky and muddy and a little bit too shambolic. And so you, especially with the first Momus McClymont album, you dragged me back to something a bit more like my 80s sound or 90s yeah. sound, you know, the early 90s albums I made like Voyager or whatever, which a lot of people still like. And so in a way, songs like My Greatest Mistake, which turned out really well, I really liked the way that sounded. It was almost like a guilty pleasure or a forbidden fruit, because by this time I'd sort of made so much forbidden. I'd put all that shiny, glossy synth pop sound out of the picture. So in a way, Momus McClymont was a way to indulge it secretly on the side. But then when we started this McClymont 2 album, I thought something had changed, you know, and I didn't want those shiny digital synth sounds anymore. So we had a bit of almost a spat, not a spat exactly, but a little wobble at the beginning, because I was writing, I was finishing off my book on America, and then we'd been talking about doing a second album, and then you had all these backing tracks already composed, which you were sort of stocking up in a folder somewhere, and then you started sending them to me, and they just sounded wrong to me because my ears had changed since the last collaboration, and I didn't like those glossy reverby sounds anymore. So I then, taking a bit of a risk because it might have annoyed you or something, but I then said, well, is there any way we can approach this one differently, and make it more organic?
Yeah, you want me to.
Well, how was that wobble from your point of view?
Well, I think. I mean, going back a little bit to Momus McClymont 1. I mean, with that, like the way we worked on that was we started and I had about 4 backing tracks that were kind of going to be songs that were going to be on the record that I was thinking of making that never ever happened because they became Momus McClymont 1 songs. But with that, we kind of had, when we started off, we didn't really need to discuss what we're doing, because initially the first song, My Greatest Mistake, was really me asking you if you would sing on one of my songs, which you did.
I didn't change anything. Yeah, I didn't change the backing track at all.
So we did that, and then we did, I thought, well, that went really well, let's do another one. And we did another one, and you completely reworked it. And I thought, hey, this is really good. I like this. This is kind of like, it's collaboration, but it's weird collaboration, because it's kind of, it's non-confrontational, but it's, essentially, I had to give up any kind of, I suppose, ego. Like, there was no ego involved in that creative exchange, because I was just giving you a track and you were doing what you wanted with it. It was almost like, it's just not the way that you would work in a group where there's all that kind of touchiness about your power and, you know, changing stuff. And that didn't exist. And so that really appealed to me. It was kind of like, I thought, this is a really good way to work. And so that kind of worked really well in the first record. But like you say, we came to the second record, and my main concern was is that we'd start the second record and it would be crap or it just wouldn't work. And so I was kind of worried before we even started. And that was partly why I thought, well, I'll try and put together a whole heap of backing tracks to cover myself in case it goes horribly wrong and I can keep saying, here's a track, what about this, here's another track. Which in retrospect was the wrong thing to do. It was like, because I didn't want to make a record like Momus McClymont 1 either. I wanted to do, I mean, I really liked Bambi. I thought Bambi was great. And, you know, one of my favorite songs of this year was Lip Gloss. And I just thought, you know, that's such a fantastic sounding song. I thought I want Momus McClymont 2 to kind of be like a mixture of pop, but kind of like that as well. So I wanted something that was kind of a bit rough around the edges, but I approached it kind of the wrong way. So when we did the first song, which the first song we worked on, which was Baobab Tree, that worked out kind of really well because you really messed around with that and really dirtied it up, and I thought, well, that's great. That's a great direction for us to go, and that's kind of exactly what I imagined this record could be.
To pull your mask down from the shelf, learn to lie like everyone else, learn to lie unselfishly, if not for you, at least for me.
But then, you know, as you say, I had a bunch of backing tracks that just really weren't right for that kind of recording that we wanted to do. And so when you kind of said, you know, like, why don't we just throw everything away, like start again, let's just go right back to basics, let's not even work on kind of synthetic instruments, let's just start on, you know, rubber bands or or hitting bits of wood, and you know, that kind of really appealed to me, and I thought, yeah, that's, you know, we've got nothing to lose, you know.
So you had some rubber bands in the house, and you had some real instruments or at least bits of wood to play it on.
Well, actually, I had some rubber bands, but that was about it. So really, I just phoned up Mick Harvey, who's a friend of mine, and said, "Hey, Mick, I need to come to your studio and get some instruments, anything that's lying around, you know, toy instruments, or, you know, toy guitars, or guitar, anything that's just like, you know, that I can play around with at home." And so I just went and picked up, I got a bass guitar, an acoustic guitar, an old kind of organ, a couple of bits of percussion, and just brought them home and just thought, right, well, you know, let's just go right back to, like you say, we'll go back to the basics. And
wow, so we have to credit Mick Harvey on the album. I didn't know it was all from Mick.
And he found it really amusing because Mick had done, he'd sung a couple of songs on my A to Z record, which is all, it's all very kind of, you know, synth driven. And he was very amused when I said, okay, Nick and I are starting this record and we're kind of going right back to, you know, just hitting bits of wood and playing with rubber bands, and he just thought that was, you know, very amusing. So he really liked that. You know, he was very happy to give me a bunch of instruments. And
there's a long history of people just piling up exotic and ethnic instruments, you know, whether it's the Incredible String Band or Public Image Limited's third album, which is which I like a lot, which is, you know, played on weird bazookies and things like that. But it's funny because my idea was, because I just finished this book called Un-America, which is about escaping from or uninventing America, and I'm sort of on an anti-Western kick at the moment, aesthetically trying to, and politically possibly also as well, trying to kick out Western influence. So I thought, let's do this ethnic music, and we'll escape from Western culture. But of course, you can't do that because you just end up sounding like the Beatles or something, you know. Yeah. This has been done so much in the 60s, and the first album that I ever had in the house and listened to was Revolver, you know, in 1967 or whenever it was, listening to George Harrison playing his guitar backwards and having sitars and all the rest of it. So in a way, a lot of Momus McClymont 2 sounds to me like the Beatles, or like 60s psychedelic stroke ethnic experimentation.
Yeah, it does to me too. I mean, I kind of, like you, I was a huge fan of the Beatles, and especially, like, you know, Rubber Soul and, you know, that kind of period where they were just starting to dabble in Eastern sounds. But the other thing that really, the thing that I suppose that really got me hooked into what we were doing in Momus McClymont 2 was after initially you had said, well, let's strip everything back, let's go to real basics, I kind of listened, I had been listening a little bit to sort of world folk music, to folk music from Eastern Europe and China and Iceland, or just generally folk music from around the world. And there was kind of similarities that, you know, like using a guitar as a percussion, a very percussive kind of instrument. Mm. And I kind of, that kind of really appealed to me. So I kind of started listening a bit to some folk stuff. And also I had been messing around with some old wind up musical toys. So that the first song that we did after, once we'd made that decision to go more, to pull everything back to that real basics, I found a really good sample of someone winding up a musical organ, and I thought that's fantastic. So I kind of just sampled that, and just put some in our garden. We got ponds, so we got lots of frogs. So I just take some frogs and put that on it too, and then just put an acoustic guitar on it, and that became Hygiene.
Yeah.
So that was kind of like, that kind of really freed me to, it kind of opened everything up to me, that song. It was kind of like, I thought, great, well, if we can make a song like this out of some frogs and a sample, and, you know, you working on top of that, that seemed to me like a great way to go. And that kind of set the tone for the way I worked anyway, whatever I was passing on to you. So, and using the guitar, the acoustic guitar, just like a very percussive, repetitive, almost like, you know, when you listen to some Eastern European folk music, it kind of sounds like the Velvet Underground, early yeah. Velvet Underground. So yeah. I kind of really like that repetitive, percussive sort of guitar sound, which I think, you know, is on two or three of the songs that we recorded.
Yeah. And was there any moment when you would, I mean, you'd presumably be surprised at the direction the song had taken, but were there any moments when you were disappointed and you'd think, well, I did a really good groove on this that's just not there anymore, that kind of reaction?
Well, because we had done the first album, I kind of, you know, maybe in the first album that would have, maybe there was a couple of times that I'd felt that, but then the results were always so good, I was so happy with the results, I really quickly got over that kind of, and what I say is I think it's a kind of ego thing, like it really doesn't matter ultimately if none of the backing track that I gave you exists, which is, you know, in the first album really happened on a couple of my favourite songs, that, you know, my track Almost Disappeared. So, you know, I was kind of used to that by the end of Moments McClimbing 1. So no, in Moments McClimbing 2, I like, that's part of the reason that I like working with Moments McClimbing, because it's always a surprise. So it's a really unusual way of working, and it's a refreshing and surprising way to work. So no, I never felt once I didn't like the way the direction of the song went.
I think there's the two songs I can think of on the first album. There was the French song Parallel, which,
that's right,
which yes. developed out of a thing we'd been working on, which we abandoned, which was we'd done a take or a pastiche or a parody of Rip It Up, which is called Robot Ape.
Something dark within me was hurt for trying anyone once. A far colder value I would defile you. Robot tape is darker yet. A robot tape is darker yet. A robot tape is darker yet. I hope to go on hurting till you.
Which you didn't like, or there was some awkwardness about it. So I went on and developed it into Parallel, and it doesn't. I think it's totally musically, it's all me. But and the second album, there's only one track like that, which was the Yes song, the Scottish Independence yeah. song, yeah. which it did start off from. I mean, it starts from a couple of your backing tracks, I think, mixed together. But then they were taken out, and you sort of, they were the splint that formed the structure, but you wouldn't know they were there. But in all the rest, it's very much the groove. Actually, just yesterday, I went back to Baobab and I was remixing Baobab and thinking there was a really good... Because the original track you sent me already had, to my ear, a very African sound.
It did. There was some very African-sounding percussive parts, which I thought were really good.
All I did was get some, go to YouTube, which I often do, and there's a whole army of uncredited musicians on this album, who are all YouTube players, basically people recorded, wherever in Mali or Senegal, playing weird instruments. So I'm doing is adding those field recordings and things into your backing tracks.
And I mean, some of the backing tracks as well, I use field recordings that I'd found of. Sort of horns, weird Eastern European horns that I'd found that I managed to, fit into songs. So it was kind of, we both are big fans of the, Burn album. So it was kind of a little bit like that too, but not so pretentious. It was more, and it was also more world of kind of, it wasn't, it's more, I suppose, more focused in than say our albums kind of tends to jet set around the world, really.
People are going to say these guys have too much time on their hands. I mean, how are they so productive that they how do they have so much energy at their advanced age that they can knock off an album like this in a month and keep and do videos as well, And so, but for me, it's actually much easier working with you than it would be on my own because obviously the tracks come to me half finished already and I just have to finish them and then do a really quick scratch video and then put them up online and they're pretty much done. But what is it that gives you the drive? I mean, you have a job had a job as well.
I still work. I mean, I work freelance for Lonely Planet and book publishers. So, but that's kind of like I'll do maybe three or four hours a day. And musically, I found that I work really, really well from maybe 6 o'clock in the morning till about midday. So most of the work I would do would be even before I have to do my, the commitment I have to a job. So it was really very easy for me to get up every day at 6 o'clock and just go straight into the studio and just start working. And I like working, and I like working fast, and I don't really mind making mistakes, and I don't mind sending backing tracks that are, that aren't perfection. So, and I like working fast, and I like fast results.
And at the same time, you were doing this record with Rick Morris, the Morris McClymont project.
Well, I kind of was just finishing that off. It's kind of almost finished, but it's I kind of put it on hold when we started the Morris McClymont record. And it's interesting because it's kind of like my role in that record's more similar to, I guess, your role in Momus McClymont. Like I end up with the backing tracks and I do all the mixing and I decide where the track's going and Rick just does a vocal on it that I'll maybe chop up or, and he's good in that way. He doesn't care what I do with the track. So, and then I make the video. So I'm kind of doing... It was really good to get away from that again and just be doing the backing track and then you having to do all the hard work.
It's amazing that while the rest of us lived incrementally through the huge changes in the music industry, that we kind of didn't see it happening because we just lived each step. Like I started doing home recording or sequencing in about 1990 and home recording from 93 onwards. But because you had this 25-year time out, you came back to this totally changed landscape where you had been on Polydor, and like being called up before the president of Polydor for misbehaving on Top of the Pops and all the rest of it. This kind of weird world of a very institutional and powerful music industry. And then you come back and it's this cottage industry with digital tools. That must be an amazing contrast.
Yeah, well, that, like I said, that was when I did start making music again. The amount of freedom I had was kind of like, it was. I just thought, this is how I always wanted to make music. This is how you it should just be like sitting down with a pencil on a piece of paper, like you might do with a drawing, or you know, if you're doing making a collage, or just ripping up some bits of paper and sticking glue down on top of, you know, a sheet of card. And that's how I kind of wanted to make music. And so that was kind of how, that was great. That was how I could make music now, and that was what got me really excited about music again. And I thought, you know, and I need no one around me. I don't need, and even if I just, the finished product becomes nothing, you know, that really wasn't that important to me. It was more as a creative thing.
Sometimes I think musicians now should wear a little cardboard sign around their neck saying, "Will work for likes," because it's like we're just putting this stuff out there, not even for, not for much money, although we will make a little money with Momus McClymont. Both albums have gone into profit. You know, it's like we do it now for social media or for advertising for live shows or whatever it is. We did a live show together in which you mimed all the way through very manfully. mimed my synth, but you were doing some backing vocals live. How was that live show, by the way?
The live show was great. I mean, it was sad that I chose to mime, I guess, keyboards, but that was kind of like...
Because the last person you'd mimed for was Kylie Minogue, wasn't it?
That's right. So both of my last live appearances have been miming. Don't know what that says about me. The Momus McClymont show was great, but I couldn't remember any of the parts, so there was no point in me even learning them. And really, it didn't really matter, you know. I'd like to think, I mean, it'd be great if we ever did a show again. We kind of, you know, it was more of a live kind of performance, but it was a lot of fun, and it was good to see you, you know, sweating your butt off, working like a demon, you know. So
I just dance live. I mean, that's the main thing. If you're performing to backing tracks, you have to give value. So
we're kind of like sparks, you know. We had that kind of like, yeah. And that was good.
So do you have any questions for me? Because in a way we just collaborate and we're very terse. We send one line emails to each other like, that was great, and I'm running out of superlatives or whatever it is. But you must have some questions for me.
I mean, yeah, like you say, we don't really talk to each other. We probably spoke more in this album because we had to work out what we were doing, where we kind of started, and which direction we were going. I guess with you, sort of the way I kind of worked on this album was, whenever I would send a backing track and you finished a track, that kind of would sort of also inform where I was thinking of going with the next track. So in that respect, I didn't really need to talk to you. We were kind of...
It was a dialogue in music, and that was really interesting. For instance, like when I did the Charles the Lobster Man song, and then the next track you gave me had this Syd Barrett feel to it, a very strong Syd Barrett feel to it, and I thought, wow, he's subtly guiding me in that sort of whimsical direction, which is great because it was very interesting. I mean, I'd been doing these, you know, I'd been doing My Life in the Bush of Ghosts or whatever, and then suddenly we're at Syd Barrett, which is a very, you know, it's an unexpected move.
Well, that was interesting because that track was, both those songs, Charles the Lobster Man and The Shape of a Pear, were interesting because we did Charles the Lobster Man, and you know, it was up there with one of my favourite songs on the album so far. And I was working in a backing track that I worked on slavishly for about 8 hours, and the whole time I was working on it, I thought, this track sucks. But I kind of kept thinking something will happen and I'll manage to save it and it's going to be great. But it finished and I half-heartedly sent it to you, and I thought, Nick's just going to think this is, you know, it's not going to be usable. And I kind of sat down afterwards and kind of a bit depressed, and I just picked up the acoustic guitar, and in 5 minutes, you know, I had shape of a pear. And I thought, well, you know, I spent a whole day slaving on a piece of shit, but at the end of it, the reward was 5 minutes of coming up with what I thought was a really great little song. And, you know, and I have no idea where it came from, the Syd Barrett thing. I guess it must have been sort of coming from the title or the something in Charles the Lobster Man. The imagery of the lyrics, I guess, I don't know. But
there's a lot of crustaceans and sea creatures in Syd Barrett, yeah.
Yeah, so so that was interesting, that how songs that we work on kind of appear or evolve.
Cinnamon's the smell of someone who would rather be alive. A reciprocal girl, a person who is stubbornly releasing all the drones in the hive. It's a reciprocal world. When the head spits from the body, the decay begins to face its own decay. It's like the quack that leads the duck.
Yeah, it's funny because we've got these encyclopedic memories. Even, I mean, I'm not a huge Syd Barrett fan. I think that's probably my favourite song on the album, actually, the Syd one, The Shape of a Pear. I mean, I like the last track as well. I always like the last one we finished best.
Yeah.
I have it's almost like catnip to me. I mean, once I finish a track, often I'm full of doubts when I'm working on it, but then when I finish it, I just love it. And I, especially when I see it with the video and it becomes something separate, you know, and I put it up on Facebook and social media and all the rest of it, and then I just think, wow, this is amazing. Where did this come from? There's something inherently very, very satisfying about making a song, and it's just very qualitatively different from, say, writing an article or a book or whatever it is, or any other kind of work that I know. There's just this amazing rush you get from doing music.
Yeah, and that last song is great because it was, I think that last song, actually, the backing track for that, part of it came from the first lot of songs I did that we rejected, and it was one that there was part of the backing track I really liked, and so I kind of reworked it. And there was always something I thought really Scottish about that song. I don't know if it's the emotional kind of content in it, but it just struck me as quite a kind of almost Scottishy, folky as well. Like it's kind of very, it's got that kind of sadness about it.
Well, to me, a lot of people were saying Luxuria Magazine. To me, it's a little bit like Parade, which is a song I really love, the last song on the first Magazine album. Just a very melancholy ballad with a slight edge of morbidity.
Mm. Yeah, but it's a great song, yeah. But yeah, would I have any question for you? It was really, you've kind of answered it, but it was the themes and the lyrical content really quickly, you know, were formed in it. And I kind of thought, is this kind of a carry-on from your book that you'd written, an American book? And, you know, you said that it kind of was. I love that the themes of this record, it's a much, you know, more confronting record as far as lyrically. And lyrically, I think it's, you know, it's fantastic.
It's a bit like angry middle-aged men, isn't it? Sort of grumpy old men sort of inveiling against American imperialism or, you know, the way kids are brought up. There's a big theme about nature, the injustice of death and also the dubious benefits of reproduction.
Biology, the bomb, the clock, better womb than tomb ripped. Coffin is a hungry box, Russian dolls, a better bus. We need people in the world, get to work now, girls. Russian dolls make womb with you, the boys are womb.
And you've built your own house, and so you basically don't have a mortgage. You don't have to work terribly hard to support yourself there in Melbourne. So you've got not just the peace and quiet of not having kids, but also you've got a place, a very nice looking, rather sparse schoolhouse like structure to live in.
Yeah, which is great. You know, that's really fantastic.
And when you go back to Europe, you can now stop off as you did in April in Japan. So we actually went in April on this holiday to the Inland Sea. I was thinking actually that Inland Sea might be quite a good album title. But that was a real peak of the year. I just wanted to say thanks for that holiday, because that arriving on Ninijima, you know, getting off the boat onto this strange enchanted island with ballet dancers and people playing the saxophone and everything, that was an amazing moment.
Can we hire them for the show?
Yeah, fantastic.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I mean, it was a fantastic, fantastic trip for us. You know, we to come to Japan, and you know, we really had our expectations were we really didn't know what to expect. You know, we'd been told, oh, we're going, you go to Japan, it's kind of like you've gone, it's like they're human, but it's like a different planet, you know, all that kind of stuff that you hear, all those cliches. And we just, as soon as we arrived in Tokyo, we just felt so completely at home and just loved it right away. And we just kind of went, what was everyone on about? You know, this is fantastic. And we had no problems, or everything was kind of, sure, we're tourists, but it kind of was, it was a really fantastic and a really kind of great trip for us. And going to the Inland Sea was just wonderful. You know, so,
well, we should do it again, you know, do it next year.
Yeah, well, you know, we've been back again to Tokyo, and we almost came for Christmas, but we thought, no, we can't go to Japan three times in one year.
Oh, we didn't talk about Scottish independence. We both we had to have a little political consultation about doing that song, yes, just to make sure we were on the same page, and we both do think that Scotland in 2014 should vote yes. I mean, the polls suggest it's going to vote no.
Yeah, I fully expect it to be no, but, you know, you hold out some hope.
So even pessimists hold out some hope.
Well, you have to, really, don't you? But it doesn't. Yeah, it's hard to. I mean, it would be fantastic, but it's hard to see that the vote would be yes.
For too long now, we've been ruled by people who don't care or go by principles. We want to live by in the land of Scotland.
I think the tide is turning a little bit. I think they were gaining 3% per week at one point, so it's possible that it'll actually happen.
Mm. But that song was interesting, because before, you know, you even contacted me and said that you know, where do you stand in Scottish independence, I had kind of worked in a couple of tracks that I kind of thought, this could almost be a bit of a Scottish kind of independence song, but I never kind of mentioned to you that maybe we should do one. So it was great when you contacted me and said that you wanted to do one. So it was another one of those kind of happy coincidences where it kind of seemed to run through our records, where, you know, we're kind of thinking along the same lines without actually talking about stuff.
And I tried to make a video which was going to be all Scottish country dances and people, but it just was so horrible. But to put, it's actually Kathmandu, scenes from Kathmandu.
Right.
And with a Laotian violin part, you know, I thought there's a certain perversity or irony which you achieve by saying, well, Scotland could become this rather impoverished mountain kingdom.
Yes.
But we wouldn't. Would we go flocking back to Scotland if it became independent, or would we continue to be diasporan?
Yeah, I think. Well, see, the political situation in Australia is not so great. It's fairly right wing now. The Labour government have been ousted, so you know things look. And you know our Prime Minister was a Thatcherite. He was, you know, at Cambridge University when Thatcher was in, so he was very pro Thatcher. So it's kind of almost like I'm back in a place that's kind of where I was when I left the UK. So I don't know, you know, you either have to bury your head in the sand and just kind of forget that and just live the life that we have up here, or you let it get to you and you kind of either become more political or you kind of leave. So,
but do you agree with the old saw about you can take the Scot out of Scotland, but you can't take Scotland out of the Scot?
Yeah, I don't know.
You don't sort of sit there wistfully dreaming of the Highlands?
I have a Scottishness in me it's odd. It's like my family are all, when I look at my father's side of the family, we're all ploughmen. We all come from the land. I still have that. You know, I love dry stone walls. I like ploughed fields. Those kind of things just are in my kind of DNA. So that kind of, that stuff attracts me. But there's aspects of Scotland that, you know, I mean, I ran away from Scotland. I basically had to get away from Glasgow. So, you know, my wife, Janet, would love to go and live in Glasgow. She just thinks it's fantastic. But, yeah, I just don't know if I would go back to Scotland if it was independent. Would you?
I think possibly when I'm old and if I had any medical problems and they had fully socialised, kept the NHS and... Because I come from a socialist Scotland where everything was free and, you know, you'd get your education and your healthcare and everything free. And, you know, if it went back to that sort of golden age, although it wasn't particularly a golden age, but, you know, you had postcard records and a kind of socialism. Yeah, maybe I would. I mean, you know, I don't know if I'm in Japan forever.
Something dark within me was hurt for trying anyone once. A far colder value I would defile you. Robot tape is darker yet. A robot tape is darker yet. A robot tape is darker yet. I hope to go on hurting. Thank you.
Thank you.